The following content is explicit. Hi, it's Mike. It's been maybe not a great week, or a great week if you are a listener of The Gist and a member of the Federalist Society. We definitely have some in that Venn diagram. But on the best of episode, I'm going to bring to you my first reaction to the leaked document that indicated that the Supreme Court was ready to overturn Roe versus Wade. That will be the second thing we play. And I talk a lot about a note that Alito put in that document about how often it is that the Supreme Court does overturn precedent. Yes, true, but to take away a right, much less precedential. But first, I will play an interview that I conducted with Emily Bazelon on either the night of or the day after Ruth Bader Ginsburg's passing. And the reason I wanted to do this was, as I talked about earlier in this week, there was a lot of chatter and speculation and recrimination and anger at the late justice that she played out the string for so long that she refused to take retirement under Barack Obama. And at the time, that was something I talked to Emily about. She had years earlier penned an essay. She probably typed it, saying that Ruth Bader Ginsburg should be free to do what she wants. And also in that essay, she said that Ruth Bader Ginsburg is not going to listen to entreaties to retire. So we revisited that. And I think you'll find it interesting what Emily's actual personal opinions are on that. I will also note that I'm taking out about 5 minutes of the original interview, not to cover up anything. It's still there in the Gist archives. It was about the politics of the moment and lame duck sessions and floor votes and stuff that didn't come to pass, so I don't want to burden you with it. But within that 5 minute chunk, there was a delightful exchange that I think reflected well on Emily and I about a senator who's in the middle of this issue. So right now, I'm going to play that chunk of tape. Here we go. This is a woman who has won the Goldwater Award from Planned Parenthood for being the best Republican on reproductive issues. And despite what ads they're playing in Maine, she actually is a backer of Planned Parenthood and legal abortion and believes in Roe versus Wade. I really don't know what is in her heart of hearts about how she should vote on this. And I further don't know if she actually has the tools to discern if someone lies to her and says, oh yes, I will vote to uphold Roe versus Wade. I don't know if she actually is able to see through that because the Kavanaugh experience gives me pause.
Right. Well, she confirmed both Justice Kavanaugh and Justice Gorsuch, despite significant evidence that she was being played at the time.
Susan Collins did indeed get played. And now we play Emily Bazelon from 2020. The Defender is a beautiful car, but beauty is, of course, sometimes only skin deep. Not with the Defender. Let's talk about the interior. It's robust, built with integrity. Yes, it's designed iconically, the exterior. That's what compelled me. My neighbor Jay says, Mike, you see what's on the block? It's a Defender. And I look down the block, and indeed there is. And me and Jay, the neighbor, and Michelle, we gather around the Defender. We peer in the window. I have to say, I don't want to make this a little too tawdry, but we lust, or perhaps we kvell. To drive the Defender is to explore with greater confidence. We looked at the cargo capacity, more room for the gear. There's really a wide range of adventures. The Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender. Hi, this is Mike Pesca. And this is, I guess we're going to call it an emergency gist and a sad gist because Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg had died. According to NPR, days before her death, Ginsburg dictated a statement to her granddaughter, which said, "My most fervent wish is that I will not be replaced until a new president is installed." That wish, I believe, turns to fear with Mitch McConnell's statement saying, essentially, we shall go forward when given a nominee with a vote. Joining me now is Emily Bazelon, who is a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine, senior research fellow at Yale Law School, and of course, contributor and a panelist on the Slate Political Gabfest. Emily, thanks for joining me.
You're welcome.
And also, I think condolences, because you did know Ruth Bader Ginsburg fairly well. Is that right?
Yes. Justice Ginsburg served on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals with my grandfather years ago, and she lived in the same building in the Watergate as my grandparents. And so I knew her also personally because my grandmother had a tailor, like a clothes maker, who Justice Ginsburg admired, who for a while was also making her some clothes. So I've also interviewed her professionally. But you know, it's funny, Mike. I mean, what I mostly think about right now is that when I think of myself as like a professional woman involved in law, like there's so many ways in which that came out of Justice Ginsburg's, the world that Justice Ginsburg made possible for so many people.
Yeah. And if it's not too personal or telling tales out of school, so your grandfather, David Bazelon, am I right about that?
Yes.
Was that who? Yeah. So he was one of these guys. There's always in every generation people who would have been on the Supreme Court or should have been on the Supreme Court, but for some vagaries of who was in office at the time. So he was an esteemed justice. Did you ever talk to him about his opinion of Justice Ginsburg's jurisprudence?
So Justice Ginsburg came on to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals shortly before my grandfather took senior status in the early 80s. And they actually clashed in some cases. My grandfather was more of a liberal than Justice Ginsburg was in a few cases involving the habeas rights of people in prison. So these are late stage appeals after you've exhausted your direct appeal. What are the rules? How do you challenge your conviction at that stage? And my grandfather thought that he had lost Justice Ginsburg's vote to, at the time, Judge Scalia. They were all on this court together. And I think he, at the time, worried that Justice Ginsburg might not prove to be as much of a liberal as he hoped. He was very much in that mold. But once she went to the Supreme Court, I think in a lot of ways she was emboldened. Her jurisprudence became stronger in that regard.
Was it just that the law dictated her positions?
I mean, that's a really interesting question. I need to go back and read these opinions and decide for myself. I think one of the questions would be, did the law dictate the result? Justice Ginsburg was very much a proceduralist. She was a real stickler for the rules. And so it's very possible that my grandfather saw more wiggle room in the rules than she did. And maybe when I go back and look at those opinions, I'll agree with her. I'm not sure. But the other question was whether she had her eye at the time on the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. But then again, also think about the status of your grandfather and the leeway he would feel to operate within the law, given his status, and what she had to feel, knowing what we know about her upbringing and her path to the Supreme Court and how constrained and kind of perfect she always had to be to attain her positions. So is there a case that a very conservative justice can get on the Supreme Court, and yet we would still have Roe versus Wade as the opinion that determines our abortion policy?
I think we could have like some empty shell of Roe versus Wade. I don't think that we would have access to abortion. I think that access to abortion would become a state by state matter. There are ways in which that's already starting to happen. And low income women in particular and more women of color have had trouble accessing abortion easily for a few years now, depending on where they live. But I think you would see a real acceleration of that. And so the notion that there is a national right to access to abortion services would end effectively.
What about everything else? What about the other extremely important ways that Ruth Bader Ginsburg's vote mattered?
Well, right now we have a situation in which there have been instances in the last few years where Chief Justice John Roberts has sided with the court's liberal wing, in some cases involving presidential power, like the case about adding a citizenship question to the census. And those have been important moments for maintaining the court's kind of legitimacy, I would argue, and for exercising some kind of restraint on the court's right wing. If we have a nominee in the mold of Gorsuch or Kavanaugh or Thomas or Alito, then Roberts will not have that kind of swing vote power anymore. And so in some of these cases, that is going to make a difference. And, you know, I think we can also ask some questions if the Supreme Court ends up in some way involved in the adjudication of the November election, then will this appointee be playing a role in whatever it decides?
Right. When the swing justice shifts from Roberts to, I guess it would be Gorsuch, a lot changes.
Exactly. I mean, right. It's already been a shift to have Roberts in this position. But I think when you think of one of Trump's appointees as holding that role, that really changes what the court could do.
So I want to go back and talk about, I agree with your supposition that anything that changes the subject off of things like the coronavirus and the economy helps Trump. But if it becomes a referendum on this issue on legal abortion, I mean, the polling is pretty clear. It does depend a little bit how you ask the question. But America is supportive. I don't know, overwhelmingly supportive. But if everyone in America just voted on that issue, even given how the Electoral College is constructed, it would be a good result for Democrats. People want legal abortion by and large. They want Roe versus Wade. How much does that matter, though, in how politics is played these days? Will people see it as just a straight up and down vote?
I mean, the traditional answer to your question has always been that conservatives pay more attention to the court, to the Supreme Court, that it gets their base out to vote in a way that liberals haven't matched, that there's been a certain complacency on the Democratic side, in part because Roe is in place, and in part because of victories, like, for example, in marriage equality, that have kind of, I think, lulled liberals to a certain degree into not noticing as much the very conservative moves the court has made toward, you know, corporate power or ending campaign finance limitations in Citizens United. And so the question is whether this time will be different, whether Democrats and the left see this as the huge potential earthquake coming their way that it could be and vote accordingly, not just like more enthusiastically, but in greater numbers. And I just don't think we know the answer to that.
Right. Well, also given that we're talking about the swing justice shifting from Roberts to Gorsuch, might the Affordable Care Act actually be imperiled?
Right. So I wrote a piece, I think maybe a year ago, that was about this question of how far the Supreme Court could lurch to the right. And the question you're asking was at the center of that piece. Like, if you have big social reform legislation along the lines of the New Deal, and you have a court that is tempted to strike down those kinds of laws, like, does the rest of the democracy stand for that? Does it hold? Do we have a real move to expand the number of Supreme Court justices as the only tool that Democrats have to rein in the court? I mean, remember that the current number 9 comes from a statute in the 1870s. It's not written into the Constitution. The number of justices changed 3 times in the 1860s. FDR, of course, did not succeed in his promise or plan to increase the number of justices, but in a sense, he didn't have to because votes started switching among the justices after he threatened that. And that was how the Supreme Court actually sort of pulled itself back from the brink of becoming utterly at odds with the American people and Congress and the president. And so we'll just have like some big structural, huge breakers coming our way, and these questions about whether the court will sort of realign itself, because there is danger in being the least powerful branch that if you're totally out of sync with the rest of the country.
Yes, and I don't sense that America is so willing to engage in large experiments, large governmental process reform experiments. But, you know, there's a chance that if this is so unpopular, Joe Biden could say, that's fine. When I get in, I'm putting 5 more justices on the Supreme Court.
Right. I mean, it's not a magic number. Like, we've had it. We're used to this number of 9, but it's not required. It's a choice.
It doesn't even have to be an odd number, I found.
Yeah, there's a whole interesting argument that we'd be better off with an even number. They would compromise more, etc. I don't think I'm sold on it, but maybe you are.
No, I've seen government agencies like the, not the FCC, but the Elections Committee.
Yes,
which has an even number, and it just, they deadlock on everything. They never do anything.
I mean, you could make an argument we'd be better off with the Supreme Court deciding fewer of these huge social questions, right? Because they are the least democratic branch, and you can argue, like, we should decide more of these things through elected legislatures or even through ballot initiatives. There's that argument.
Yeah. I think John Roberts makes that argument sometimes.
Sometimes. Barack Obama actually kind of made that argument, too.
Okay. If you could talk to the layperson and tell them, look, I know you're very focused on Roe versus Wade, and you should be, and you should be focused on an abortion rights, but consider this, because this other area of law is hanging right in the balance. What is that other area?
Well, I guess I'll give two answers. I mean, there are many answers, but two answers. One involves whether state and local gun regulations are going to be upheld, right? So the Supreme Court in 2010, for the first time, said that there's a constitutional right, individual right to bear arms in the Second Amendment. But they compromised. They let most of the state and local gun laws that limit gun ownership stand. There are lots of those laws in many states, especially in blue states, and there is an appetite among the conservative justices, including Kavanaugh and Gorsuch, we know this from opinions they've written, to strike down those laws. So that's a space to watch. And I think another really important one is the power of federal agencies. For Justice Thomas and Justice Gorsuch, there's been this real interest in limiting what federal agencies can do. You know, federal agencies are where the experts in the government are. They're the ones who write all the actual rules and regulations that help keep the air clean, the water clean, help keep food safety, you know, all these different agencies we have, the EPA, the FDA, the alphabet soup of them. If the conservatives figure out a way to really limit the power of federal agencies, then you would see a real sea change in how American government works and, you know, a kind of constitutional move toward deregulation.
Okay. So here's my last question. When Ruth Bader Ginsburg, when it was the sunset of Barack Obama's term, there was some talk that maybe Ruth Bader Ginsburg, knowing how all this works, should step down. I mean, she was an octogenarian, still very alert and feisty. And we all saw the documentary, I think, and actually full of life. And it was people were reluctant to say to do so because, you know, how dare you take away the agency from such an important and vital figure. But that was one discussion when it very much looked like she would survive until another Democratic president. Now that she hasn't, should we reconsider that question?
Yes. I mean, look, I think it's if you think about Justice Ginsburg's own life work and what she cared about, in particular, gender equality, I mean, this was what animated her from the time she was in law school and maybe earlier. She wanted women to have the same opportunities as men. She wanted men to have an expanded scope of possibilities in front of them, too. She wanted the kind of strictures of traditional gender roles to be loosened in America. So when you think about all of that, and, you know, also she was a huge champion for voting rights, for the Voting Rights Act, for the notion that making sure that people of color have equal political power and chance to vote in this country. That was a huge motivating force for her in the Shelby County decision in 2013. All of that is at risk now. And so in hindsight, I think it's clear that it was a mistake that she didn't leave the court earlier. I wrote a piece, and I can't remember what year it was, but years ago, making the argument that everyone yelling at her to get off the court was not going to work. She was an indomitable spirit, right? I mean, incredibly strong, determined woman. And that's how she got to where she was. It also meant, I think, that she made this real mistake of judgment in refusing to leave. And I think you're right that she bet on Hillary Clinton winning the election. And of course, that didn't happen. And so there's always going to be this kind of unintended aspect of her legacy that is going to, it just is going to depend what happens next, right? In terms of whether the gains that she cared so much about, whether we're going to get to keep them or not.
The answer to that was you wrote it in December of 2013. It was called Stop Telling Ruth Bader Ginsburg to Retire. It's Counterproductive. I'll read the last graph. The justices could give us the gift of regular turnover themselves by agreeing to adopt voluntary term limits. No constitutional amendment necessary. But that would take the unanimous collective action from a fractured group of nine on perhaps the most personal issues of all, their own work lives. It's another dream that won't come true, but at least it makes for better holiday conversation than liberal complaints about Ginsburg's determination to stay put. I almost want to leave on a more humane note, so why don't we do that? Do you think her greatest legacy is in the laws she wrote, what she represented, who she was to other female lawyers and justices? Where will we and how will we remember her?
I mean, her greatest legacy is just the tremendous strides that women have made toward equality since she was a little girl growing up in Brooklyn. We just live in a different world where, you know, everything isn't perfect, but women have so many more opportunities. We believe in ourselves so much more, I think, collectively than we did then. And that's what she wanted for us. So her legacy is her granddaughters. It's all the people who dress up as her at all Halloween. It's the way she became a feminist icon because she cared so much about that kind of dream and opening those doors for people. One of the things she loved to say about the Supreme Court, you know, when Justice Sotomayor, Justice Kagan was nominated, people said, aren't you so glad that there's going to be another woman on the court? You know, first you got to serve with Justice O'Connor, but now she's gone and now there'll be two or three. And she said, sure, but I want there to be six. I want there to be seven. Like, she didn't see any ceiling there. It wasn't to her such a victory to have two or three people. She thought that women should be represented on the court in a majority, just like men had been for so long. That was her sense of where she wanted the world to go. And I think that for so many women, she was an inspiration because she just had such a deep-seated conviction that we could do all those things and that it was fair to ask.
Since 1973, women in this country knew they had the right to an abortion. The limits of permissibility were never settled, but it has been the case for almost 50 years that a woman, should she choose, could end her pregnancy legally and with proper medical care. The 49-year time frame is significant because it means that no woman who could now become pregnant ever lived in a country where she ever had to worry about the legality of getting an abortion. In fact, all American women who are under the age of 60 have lived their entire lives as reproductive creatures, knowing that as soon as they were able to get pregnant, they would be able to acquire an abortion, should that be necessary. Now, that doesn't mean the Supreme Court can't change its mind on things. And this is why, in a note in what will become the majority opinion unless a justice defects or a rewrite happens, Justice Alito laid out the many instances where the Supreme Court has changed precedent. This was an anticipation of the argument about stare decisis, the idea that precedent itself gives law extra legal weight. Justice Alito's list is instructive. There are some cases, you know, Obergefell, Miranda, maybe, you know, Batson covering race and jury selection. Some you don't, or at least some I didn't know. Maybe you happen to be Scott Shapiro, Emily Bazelon, Barack Obama, and other legal experts who might be listening to The Gist. But so in there's a case about Native American gambling, and there's Payne versus Tennessee, which is about victim rights statements, and a case about excluding women from juries. There are really a couple dozen cases cited. But in all those cases, a right was granted, not taken away. The right for gay people to marry. The right to have counsel. The right to decline to talk to police officers when arrested. And I don't agree with this, right? But also in Citizens United, the right for corporations to have speech. It's all about granting a right. This pending reversal of Roe takes away a right, and one held and used and assumed to be true and a right that people could use for 50 years. It's really important. I don't think Roe was exquisitely reasoned. I do think it's a good or at least interesting point that I've heard opponents of Roe raise, that because Roe was a Supreme Court decision, wasn't allowed to play out in the way politics usually plays out. We may have seen anti-abortion laws tried and failed. And so it might be the case that but for Roe in 2022, states like Texas, Mississippi, Idaho, and Alabama would know that their citizens opposed anti-abortion regulations. Maybe. I'll grant that. I also know that there has been no right granted, then revoked over so long a period of time. Do you want to say the right to an abortion was an invented right? This is what some critics of Roe say. They also say that the right to privacy, as found in Griswold versus Connecticut, was invented in 1965. Okay. But inventions made 50 or 60 years ago and used hundreds of thousands of times a year embed themselves in the actual functioning of life. I am 50. I am further from the adoption of Roe versus Wade as settled court of the land than Roe versus Wade was from the presidency of Warren G. Harding, who happened to be the first president for whom women could cast a vote. The Supreme Court has, if this ruling stands, taken away a longstanding, long understood, long regarded as necessary right that is popular with the people. And that is not good for the people, and that is not good for the institution of the court. And that's it for today's Best Of show. Thank you to Corey Wara, assistant producer, and Joel Patterson, senior producer of The Gist. And as always, Michelle Pesca, whose actual title is COO of Peachfish Productions. Un pru de pru du pru. Thanks for listening.